if you look in this week's parsha, the end of last week, beginning of this week, you see there's an interesting something that needs explanation. And that is that it says that when Sarah died, she was buried in a place called the Machpelah. Now, the whole idea of burial, the grave, the site of the grave, what exactly happens over there, a lot of mystical things that are connected with this idea. But what's especially interesting here is that that is a very unusual place. It says that in that site was buried Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, and Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov and their wives, except for Rachel for certain reasons, but that's where they are today. The Gemara's got descriptions of somebody who went inside and saw them. Amazing event that happened, trying to tell you about maybe. But what needs to be understood is this. Let's start like this. The place is called the Machpelah. Machpelah is the name of that cave. But the word actually means a thing that's double. Double. Kefel in Hebrew, Machpelah, the root Kefel, means something that's doubled. Now, that needs a little explanation. Why was it that when Avram bought the place, why was it that particular place that he wanted to bury Sarah? What's it got to do with who she was? What's the idea of something being doubled? That needs the explanation. The Gemara in Erubin says that the cave was double. That's what it means. It was a cave in which they were buried, and it was double. It was one cave within another one. Actually, an argument in the Gemara whether it was like a house and an attic, in other words, a house with another house above it, a room with a room above it, or was it a room within a room? The doubles, already you can begin to feel, even if you don't have such a Kabbalistic streak in you, you can begin to feel that the time when you come across this kind of talk is, if you read mystical sources, any sources that deal with the spiritual world, they always talk about the fact that the spiritual worlds are higher than this one. We must have come across that. Talk about the higher world. When we talk about heaven, for example, heaven and earth, we don't mean the blue sky and the land. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a higher dimension. So we picture it, we're not supposed to picture it like that, but the analogy in the physical world is that there's a dimension that's higher physically, right? And then there's something that's lower physically. So there's the heavens, which are sort of above, and but what it means is that there's something higher and something lower. The higher world gives to the lower world. Sometimes, however, we don't talk that way. Sometimes we talk about something that's inside something else. The mystical language actually often talks about what's called pnimius. Pnimius means the inner dimension, which means that that's very interesting. If you want to move from an outer dimension or a lower dimension or a more physical dimension into a more spiritual dimension, there are two ways to talk about it. Either you're moving up or you're moving in. Actually, they're both true. They're both true. You are moving up. That means in terms of spiritual level, you're moving up in the spiritual levels. But in terms of moving towards the core of a thing, you're moving towards the center. Of course, neither of them is accurate if you try and make a picture out of it. If you're trying to move towards the center of yourself, so if you try and picture someplace inside, now that's not relevant, it doesn't want to help much. On the other hand, if you try and picture up, it also doesn't, it's not too helpful because, you know, space is no more spiritual really than... But there are two ideas that are both valid depending on what element you're trying to express, which metaphor, which marshal, which analogy you're trying to use to explain those few and faint areas of the spiritual world that you can't express in words. So we talk about going up and we talk about going in. Here you see that the Gemara says it was a cave where it had two dimensions. The cave was a place where there was another one inside of it, and you went into one first, then you went into an inner place. Or maybe it was a place where there was a cave and then it was like you could climb up to another one above it. Now the obvious question we have to answer is, what's the difference? You know, they were buried in that place. What's the difference if it was one place, two places? You know, you follow, that's the problem. What's the Torah? There's nothing in Torah that's sort of accidental or that, you know, physical, geographical description. That's not important to us. Everything in Torah is a spiritual thing. Of course it's also true. Of course it's a cave that actually looks that way. Definitely. But that's not what we're trying to extract. So let's try and see if we can study the subject. Actually, the truth is that this subject is very close to the heart of women. Because the mystical understanding is that that cave, what double means, is the place where this world meets the next world. That's the double. double means that there's a spiritual world and a physical world. And the two are perfect reflection of one of the other. The place where you move from this world into the next world, that's called the kever, that's called the grave. That's a place of tremendous sadness and tremendous happiness. We see the sad side because we see that it's an ending of one pathway. We don't see the other side. The happiness is that that's where the real spiritual dimension begins. But the place where they meet is the place where you have like a mirror, or where one dimension reflects the other one perfectly. That's why it's called Machpel, exactly where the two meet exactly. Try to understand this. Of course, it means where the two meet, and there's where you see, if you have spiritual eyes, you see that the one reflects the other perfectly, that the spiritual world is reflected perfectly in the physical world. You'll see that it's a woman's talent. It's a woman's talent. I'm sure you are aware, you know, we've said enough already that I'm sure you're racing ahead of me, and you have already realized that the womb is called the kever. You know that. A woman's womb is called the grave. You know that? You don't know that?
No.
Tichas kever, what's called the opening of the womb, the word that the Halacha uses over there is the grave. Very interesting. It doesn't mean negative, it means it gives life. The Gemara says that the grave is a place where something goes in over there that looks like it's sad or looks like it's coming to an end. And then what happens is there's a life that's got no comparison to the life that was before that comes out of there. That's exactly what the womb is, the Gemara says. The same thing. The seed that's formed in the womb of a child doesn't look like it's going to be a human. In fact, if you were to assess what the chances are of this speck of microscopic genetic material actually becoming a human, you would think, definitely not, it's going to just waste away. And what happens is that's the place where it turns around and a life is formed. In fact, that's one of the proofs the Gemara brings of an understanding of the next world, of understanding that the dead will be revived again, that they will actually stand up physically. The Gemara says, on the contrary, it's easier to understand in death, it's easier to understand in death that there's an existence after that than it is by the birth of a child. Because the Gemara says that by the birth of a child, something is formed into a human that never was a person before. Whereas when it's the grave, something's formed into a person that was a person before. That's much less of a miracle. After all, what goes into the grave is in a human being. So when it gets reconstituted one day, so it's the pulling together of the same parts that were once together. Not bad, but not as miraculous as when a person who never was a person before just was some liquid material, which is genetic chemical material. That the Gemara says it's like a king who said to his servants, I want you to build for me a palace, a wonderful palace, with all wonderful details. And he gave them a place where there was all raw material, stones and wood and all the things they needed, and they built him a beautiful palace. And the Gemara says, there was once a king who told his servants to build him a palace, and all he gave him was water. And they built a palace, the same palace as the others did, with all the brick and stone and everything, and all they had was water. Which is more wonderful? There's definitely that. How did they do that? That's a miracle. Well, a human being has to be reborn one day after having all the pieces that were once there. That's crafty, that's craftsmanship. But it's not nearly as wonderful as a person who never was in the world who gets born. But we see it exactly that way because we are bound by the physical dimension, so our eyes only see the one side. We see that when a child's born, who never was a person before, you know, we say ourselves, you know, go back to what you were doing before, no, another child is born. But if you're sitting by the side of the cemetery one day, and the ground started to shake, and a few bones started to, you know, put themselves together, you'd be in trouble. You'd need to see a professional probably after that. But actually, from a spiritual point of view, it's much less miraculous. Much less miraculous. Now, I never thought about that. It says ma'ara, which means a cave. I never thought about the word itself here. Not sure I'd finish. I have to think about it. We'll have something to say in a minute about some of these words. You see. Now, so you have this idea of a connection. So why is you see this? You see that there's a connection between spiritual and physical. Okay, that takes place most sharply. You see it at the point of transition, either from the spiritual world into this world, that takes place in what's called the womb, or from this world to the next world, that takes place in another kind of a womb. That's what it is. Now, you see that always going around this idea of a burial place, you have this double idea. And depending on whom the person is, about whom we're speaking, so then, for example, it says, by Moses, by Moshe Rabbeinu. It says, no one knows the place of his grave. Very interesting. No one ever knew it. He went alone, and no one ever saw where it was. There are commentaries who say that not only did no one ever know where it was, but none of the contamination of death ever came out of him. No one ever touched him. You know, when a person, Lo Aleinu, dies, they have to be prepared in a certain way. very clean and dressed in white, and very special things that have to be done. No one, and then the people who touch the person, they need a cleansing afterwards because they've been in contact with this end of the double of the interface, which is the third side, which can depress a person. But Rav Moshe Rabbeinu, no one ever was involved with him. So none of the laws of ritual or social impurity ever came out into the world from his death. That's one thing that happened, a remarkable thing. Secondly, no one ever knew or knows where he's buried. The Maharal says it means that Moshe Rabbeinu was a man who was entirely in the spiritual world. That even while in the physical world, he was in the spiritual world. That's why it says, for example, you remember he spent 40 days and nights in the higher world without eating, drinking, or sleeping. Or it says, Bechol Beis Nemon, who he's entrusted in my whole house. Or it says that El Peah Babel, I speak to him face to face, Hashem says. Or it says that Moshe Rabbeinu had a speech defect, he couldn't speak properly. In Kabbalistic writings, it says he didn't have a defect, he had a perfection. The reason he couldn't speak properly was because what was in his mind was in the infinite dimension, couldn't be put in finite words. You follow? It wasn't because he had a defect, a terrible anti-Torah, anti-Semitic thinking, to think that, you know, he was a man who was like imperfect. You know, he had a psychological problem, you know. That's definitely not... The concept is that he was in Hashem's world of infinity where the things are as they are. You can't put them into finite, bite-sized portions which are words. Words always lie. Best words lie, because at best they don't tell the whole story. You never can share with somebody what you really feel. The only way you can ever share with somebody what's in your own spiritual dimension is with somebody who knows what that is already. So he understands what you mean. You don't even have to say any words in such a situation. But to try and put to somebody who doesn't understand in words will never get it across. It's hopeless. Oh, so I'll try and get there. Oh. So that spiritual world can never be put into the physical world. Obviously they can't meet. One is infinite, and as things really are, the other is in a finite, broken down world. They never can meet. So of course Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't speak. So the Maharal says after the Torah was given, he could speak perfectly. The miracle of putting the two worlds together, the real birth of the world, the miracle, is that Hashem took the spiritual world, which is called the Torah, which could never be put into the physical world, and he put it in. Ah, oh, that's miraculous. Fine. Yes, it is. That's why it says Hashem appeared on the mountain. What does it mean? So when you're 6 years old, you think, you know, a man in a white beard with a white beard, you know, you appear. The idea is that the infinite dimension melted in or made contact with the finite, which of course is impossible. But that's what Hashem did. That's the miracle of this world. That you have a human being who has a body which is finite, and inside it, and somehow not destroying it, you have an infinite neshama. After Hashem did that miracle of putting Torah, the infinite, into words which are finite, Moshe Rabbeinu spoke normally after that. That's what it says. But it's not our subject for now. We know because it says, Eilat Vori Moshe Dibbe Moshe. This is what he spoke. So we know that he could speak after that. We're not going to get to women over here. That needs explanation. I'm not sure exactly how to explain it. It has to obviously be connected. It has to be that there was a transcendent experience. It was an angel that made him do that. And that took him into a plane where... Well, I can tell you that the being burnt, it says in mystical writings, that when speech and the spiritual world are opposite to each other. You know that in the mystical sources, people are going to go early here, we're not going to get to the subject, but in the mystical sources it says that a child understands the whole spiritual world until he begins to speak. When he can start to tell you about it, then he loses what it was. Or it says that a child in the womb, children can see things that we can't see. But they just can't tell you about it. As soon as they start being able to put it into words, they can't grasp it anymore, obviously. One second. It says that the child in the womb knows the whole Torah. As the child is born, an angel hits him on the mouth, and he forgets all that he knew. So it says that, why does it hit him on the mouth? What does it mean, hits him on the mouth? So it makes him forget, but why do you make a person forget by a blow on the mouth? So in the Kabbalistic writings it says, it's the ability to speak. The angel gives him the ability to speak. It makes his mouth that now which can speak, and then he has to forget the spiritual wisdom. You follow? Because once you can deal with the finite, and you can make things finite, you can't hold an infinite anymore. Except through Torah, this amazing connection, which is what a woman can do. Yeah? We are supposed to transcend to another level. But the miracle of this world is that now the spiritual world can be put into the physical. The miracle of having Torah in the world, let's understand, the null position, the beginning position, is that the two worlds are separate, they could never meet. They are spiritual and physical, they can never meet. The miracle of the world that we can never understand is that the two do fit together. But you can put in finite words, Torah, which is infinite. But you can speak out words of davening that actually take you to transcendent place. But you can have a piece of meat that's no different than a monkey, And inside it you could have a human neshama, which is infinite. That's the miraculous dimension of the world. Yes. This is coming from your professional side. So you have to go in to work out exactly what that and what those letters mean. I don't know much about that. Yes. It wasn't physical. It was physical also, but we're dealing with much higher. Anyway, just 1 second. Now, so you have a meeting of these two dimensions. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he, for example, another thing it says by him, his name is Moshe Moshe. You know, everybody has two names. I don't know if you're aware of that. Everybody has two names. It's the same name twice. Your name, you have two names. One of your names is in the higher world, and one of your names is in this world. And the Torah often speaks that way, like it says, Abraham, Abraham, Hashem speaks to him twice. Or Moshe, Moshe, Hashem calls his name twice. Why is that? There are many explanations. But Kabbalistically, the explanation is that Hashem calls a person, when Hashem calls a person, he calls him at his higher level, the way you are spiritually, and he calls you the way that you manifest physically. But always in the Torah, when the Torah uses a person's name twice, it always has punctuation between the two. Because a person never can be perfectly the same in one as he is in the other. So always when you look in the Torah, you know this punctuation in Torah, you don't see it in the Sefer Torah, but the tradition has what's called the trop, which is the timing, the little signs that tell you how to read the punctuation, or what's called the tune. It even has a way that you sing it, but actually it breaks up the words into punctuation so you can get an understanding. Always the names that are mentioned, when there are two of them, have an instruction that you pause between the two, because the higher essence of a person is manifest in a crude and imperfect way in their body. The only exception is when Hashem calls Moshe. He calls Moshe, Moshe like that without any interruption at all between them. So the Kabbalists and the Maharal says it means that it made no difference by him. He was here, there, the same. It made absolutely, he could be here and eat like a human being, he could go. The only thing he got to separate from his wife. Because he was on that plane where he couldn't, that element of physicality, again you have to think about it in terms of what we're saying, he had to always be ready at that level, and therefore the two of them decided to separate so that he could always be holding at that level. But there was no difference. So the Maharal says that that's why his grave is unknown. The grave is where the physical element condenses into being in the sharpest way. Because there it's not elevated by the spiritual. Actually, it is elevated. There is a certain force that still always remains by the grave. Some of the neshama always remains there. Some of the nefesh always hovers over there. And that's what will reconnect again when the person stands up again. But generally speaking, where the body really is the least animated, where the neshama is most disconnected from the body, that's there. And Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have that. So that element is unknown in the world. The place where he's buried, you follow, since he was at that level, so we don't have any contact, it's not just that people didn't know. You know, there are other explanations that if people known when he was buried, they would have made it a shrine, and they would have worshipped him as a divine or idolatrous kind of a thing. So therefore his grave is unknown. There are other reasons also, but mystically, spiritually, good. Now, let's go back to the Machpelah. We have here a cave that's double. Double means it's the place where the lower world meets the higher world. That's obvious, that's exactly what it is. Now a woman is able to do that. A man isn't able to do that. A man's able to flit around in the higher world, but it's very hard to bring him down into this world. A woman is able to perfectly and gracefully and graciously make the connection. A woman is able to relate to the higher world, take a speck or a spark of it, and then to build it into something real in this world. That's why she merits to have within her body that place, which is that place that can meet, it can put both worlds together and produce from the one the other. That's what it means to be a woman. Sarah, and if you want to understand this, we spoke about this last night, I won't go into all the details, but Sarah, who was buried there, was exactly that. It says that, it's not much to explain, it says that Sarah Imenu was a woman, when Avram came to bury her there, that was exactly where she had to be buried. Sarah was a woman who, that's fascinating. I mean, not only was she a woman who gave birth to the Jewish people, she was the first Jewish mother, not Avram Avinu, and she, they had the child, Yitzchak. It says not only that, but she died at the point of separation. Do you know how she died? She died because what happened was the Akedah. Avram put Yitzchak on the altar, and he sacrificed him, or he was about to sacrifice him. Somebody ran and told Sarah that this had happened, and she died instantaneously. It says. When she heard the news, she died. Some say it means, I'm not sure whether it means, there is one of the commentaries, he says it means that the person who brought the news wasn't able to complete the story. He started to say about the Akedah, but before he could say that it didn't happen, already her neshama left her. Or it could be that, despite hearing that it never happened, but the shock of hearing that the son that she bore when she was 90 or whatever it was, that was going to be, you know, that would happen. Because Avraham Avinu didn't tell her what he was going to do. He just couldn't, to tell her that he was going to take his son and sacrifice him, that Hashem had told him. But the point is this, that her neshama left her body in connection with her son's neshama leaving his body or coming into his body. She gave birth, it's an amazing thing. She gave birth to this child in the world, and then when he went into a dimension, because mystically it says he was sacrificed. Mystically what happened was he moved from that world into the higher world. It says his ashes are always before Hashem on the altar. So he did move into that world. But not only did he move into that world, he also moved into this world. After he was sacrificed, after he went through that experience, the first thing he did was he got down off of his back and he went and got married. And he fathered the Jewish people. That means he became an entire man, an entire human being, who was able to now be that part of the chain of tradition after he had that connection with the next world. So that he was a man who lived in this world, the mystics say, he lived in this world after having died. That's the unique characteristic of the Jews. We live in this world, the non-Jewish nations live in this world, and that's their perfection and their beauty. They're supposed to beautify this world and make it a place that's suitable for spirituality. But we have the amazing job of flitting between both worlds, living in both worlds. That's why Yitzchak was born from a man and a woman who couldn't have children. He was born miraculously so that his birth would be an impossibility, so that you'd see the miraculous dimension in the natural dimension. And then he became the father of the Jewish people after he went through a sacrifice, so that he sort of lives in the next world and then he lives in this world. That's what makes us immortal. That was who Sarah was. She was the mother of such a person. So she was buried in a place where ultimate connection is between this world and the next world. The ultimate connection between this world and the next world actually is what happens between husband and wife. It's the connection between husband and wife in such a way that the woman's able to do what she has to do that brings birth into the world. I wish I could tell you the details, but you're not going to get it out of me. Of a Gemara that says, I just hinted at you, okay, you go ask your husband, or you get some lady who knows how to look it up to tell you the details. The Gemara says that there was a man, a Tana, who was given the job of measuring tombs. Okay? That's what his job was, he had to measure tombs. Why? I don't know exactly. So he went around to all the kfarim in Eretz Yisrael, and he measured them, and when he came to the Machpelah, the Gemara says he came to the place where Sarah was buried, and Adam and Chava, Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah, where they buried, and he came to the door, and he wanted to go in, he had to measure it, he had to go into Machpelah and Hebron, he had to go in. So when he came to the door, he found a guardian outside who wouldn't let him in. Who was the guardian? Who? Eliezer, Avram's servant, the faithful servant who always looked after Avram and Sarah in their house. He was standing outside the door. So this Tana asked, you know, I'm very sorry, I have to go in here. You know, I've been given the job, I have to measure, and I have to go inside and measure. So Eliezer went inside and he asked Avram Avinu, Gemara says, whether this Tana could come in and measure. So what did Avram say? Even though it's a dimension that people should never look at, the thing that you can't hardly bear to see what's in there. What did he say? Definitely. You remember Avraham Avinu's tent was open on all four sides? He never stopped anyone coming in? Achnas HaSolchim, he said, definitely, if he has to come in, let him in. And what he saw in there between husband and wife, I'm just not prepared to tell you. But he saw the most amazing thing when he went in there. The only thing he wasn't allowed to look at was Adam. Adam originally wasn't allowed to see Adam and Chava. He was only allowed to look at his feet. And it says that he saw that the light that shone from his heels was greater than the sun. That's what he saw. But Avraham and Sarah was allowed to look. Excuse me? He was allowed to look. He was married. He was on a level. He was good enough to see. Anyway, what he saw, I'm not going to tell you. But the point is that it's a place of meeting. It's the home of Avraham and Sarah. That's the intimate home where they live together forever. That's what it is. And it's the place of birth of the Jewish people. It's the place of transition from this world to the next. It's all those things together. That's what means Machpelah. Now, and of course that's why Adam and Chava are buried there. Adam and Chava were the human being. Adam and Chava were born as one person. You know that. Adam and Chava were formed in the world not as man and woman. They were formed bonded one into the other. Their backs were fused together. They didn't have a back. You know that. Then they were torn apart and given the mitzvah to get back together through their own effort, through their own of what it means to bond in marriage. But they were formed in a way that was already the perfection of Machpelah, of bonding, of unity. Now, if you look at Sarah from a woman's point of view, Sarah was that person spiritually. It says that Sarah was a person who was a woman. Let's understand this. Let's start like this. It says that one of her names was Yiska. One of her names was Yiska. She had a name called Yiska. Yiska is from the root Tzacha in Hebrew, which is the word that means, it means Sukkah, for example, a Sukkah. A Sukkah is that word. But the word Tzacha means to see through something. That's what it means. To be able to penetrate, to see through. Not just see something like the word lirot, to see. That means to see through. Sacha means like to see through something that's transparent. Why? Because it says, Ki akol sachin b'yofya. Amazing thing. She was called Yischa because everybody could see through her beauty. That's what it means. She was so beautiful that everybody could see through her beauty. What does that mean? It doesn't mean they could see her beauty. It doesn't say that. It says they could all see by means of her beauty, or they could see through her beauty. It says that Sarah was 127 years old when she died. But the prophet says, interesting, 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. It doesn't say 127 years. So the commentary, Rashi says, it means that she was as free of sin at 100 as she was at 20, or at the end of her life. That means she ended up so perfect and pure morally that she was free of sin then, like she was before she was of an age where she became responsible for her actions. And she was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. Now the point that we have to ask is, who cares if she was beautiful? You know, the Torah is interested in spiritual context. You follow? The fact that a woman is beautiful, that's Torah. We're not interested in that. That's not what we're supposed to be. On the contrary, it says that Avraham Avinu was a man who so manifested this quality. This is going to drive you crazy. Okay? Don't tell your husband this, okay? But it says that when they went down to Egypt, he says, Hinei Yodati, I know that you're a beautiful woman. You remember the story? He asked her to say she was his sister, because she was so beautiful that if they thought she was his wife, they would have killed him to take her, the Egyptians who were steeped in immorality. So he said, I know, so the commentary say, what do you mean, I know that you're beautiful? What's he making a speech here? He has to say, just please say that, or because you're beautiful, say that you are my sister. What do you mean, I know, I see that you're a beautiful woman? The commentary say, up till then he'd never looked at her. Why? Because he wasn't interested in the physical, and didn't want to make his marriage into that. This is not allowed for us, okay? Let's just be clear here. We are very lucky to be normal in this area, okay? And on the contrary, a man's supposed to look at his wife and supposed to enjoy her, and they have to be very normal in that area. So I'm not speaking halacha over here. But at that incredible level of spiritual greatness, where he was in such total control of his physicality, he chose his wife because of what her spiritual content was. But it just so happens that her physical context is the most beautiful woman imaginable. She was so incredibly beautiful, and she was beautiful as a woman. Doesn't mean she was beautiful, but she was beautiful physically, because it says that the Egyptians, whose only motivation was immorality, they praised her to the king. They came and they said, a man is around here with a woman, you know, and it's so amazing that they went and took her for him. So obviously she was very attractive in that way also. So the problem is, what does physical beauty have to do with her spiritual content? That's our problem. Now, we've spoken about this in different ways before. I'm just going to say a few ideas to just try and point out the connection between spiritual and physical idea. If you're interested in detail, last night we discussed Sarah and this area of physical sensual beauty in much more detail. You can get that recording if you're interested in the subject. But briefly, what a woman has to know is this. When a person can get themselves to a high enough level, that means if you can work on yourself spiritually, and we'll try and explain what it means, if you can get to a high enough level spiritually, then what happens is the body glows with the beauty of your neshama. But it glows beautifully as a body. The perfect level of the world, if you can really, with the world in a state of perfection, is that the physical world should be so glowing, so glowingly beautiful, that when you look at it, you're struck immediately by the spiritual. You don't see the physical. The way you do it, the way you do it is that you become so true to yourself that what people see on the outside is what's inside. That's the key. I mean, it's my whole world of study of Musa, how a person does that, and it's easy to talk about, very hard to do. But what a person tries to achieve is that the inner beauty that they have inside spiritually should manifest on the outside. There should be no falsehood, no deception. No one should ever see something on the outside that isn't actually inside. There should be plenty of things that are inside that no one ever sees. That's another story. There should be plenty of depth. There must always be depth inside that's never manifested physically, that no one could ever know about until they know you more and more and more and more. They always discover more depth. But there must never be something on the outside that isn't inside. That's deception, that's lies. If you put forward something on the outside that you actually don't have inside, that's called checker, that's called telling lies. The world was created in such a way originally that it wasn't able to lie. When the world was created before Adam sinned, the world was designed in such a way that the physical nature of the world would automatically reflect the spiritual context. It wasn't able to be deceptive. And that's why they never wore clothes. They never needed clothes, because the physical reality so perfectly reflected the spiritual reality That why on earth would anybody want to cover that? On the contrary, the way you saw their spirituality was by looking at their physicality. It was so beautiful and pure that it reflected perfectly the divine spiritual level inside. Clothes are a mark of shame. Clothes are what you do when you're... When Adam sinned, the shame came into the world in the way that he now became terribly, agonizingly aware of the fact. And if you could make the mistake of thinking he's an animal, that's an agony of shame. So to do that, to try and get away from that, he quickly tried to cover his body. He tried to make himself not look, but now there was a split between the physical and the spiritual world in such a way that the one doesn't reflect the other. Contrary, the more sharp the one is, the more the sensuality and the beauty of the physical, the harder it is to see the spiritual. That was his pain. When he suddenly realized that he damaged the world in such a way that he'd become physical, that now when you saw his physicality, you couldn't see his spirituality, that was the agony. There's nothing he could do except hide. He tried to hide himself and he tried to hide his body. And that's why we feel shame. We feel terrible shame because our body, when you the body that's exposed, is so much like an animal that you feel terrible shame. Why is it that you feel natural shame? This generation is trying to do away with it. They're trying to make a big mitzvah out of doing away with the shame. Actually, there are mystical sources that say that they actually write about it. Because in the messianic age, which is what they're beginning to feel now, there won't be any shame. It will be back to that original perfection, definitely. It's just a bit premature now, don't get carried away. Right? But the showing of the physical body is a terrible shame because the person knows that he's much more than that. But the physical exposed has the same drives and uncontrollable elements and the same physical structure, right, as an animal does. And a person feels that and he knows he's not that. And it's that dichotomy between the two that makes a person feel the way he feels. But Adam wasn't like that. I once had a Swati Rebbe who said to me, trying to explain this idea to me, he once said that the way to understand it is that it's like this, that if you look at a person now, you see an animal, you see physical. Only if you look very carefully, you can see a glow that indicates that there's something more. In the mystical writings, it says the fact that a person stands upright, and more than that, a certain glow on the face. A certain glow on the face that's lost when a person's not alive anymore, that ziv upon him, that special glow that the face has, an animal doesn't have, but it's very, very faint. It's very faint, you could miss it. Whereas when Adam was created, when Adam HaRishon arrived on earth, all you could see was the spiritual glow. If you look at a person, you see the body. If you look very carefully, you see a little bit of a glow someplace. Adam was created in such a way that you saw an incandescent light of spirituality. If you shielded your eyes very carefully, you saw the wisp of a body. That's the way it was. Exactly the opposite of the way we are. But the body was completely subservient to the spiritual existence. It was just enough to be a vehicle that perfectly reflected the spiritual essence. When he crashed the world, the principle is this. He damaged the world into a situation where now the two are in conflict. And the rule now in the world is that when you have more of the one, you have less of the other. And there's no way out of it. If you want more spirituality now, you have to do it by subduing the body. There's no other way. If you stimulate the body and make it strong and powerful and beautiful as a body, then you can't be spiritual. If you feed the body, if you get involved in physical pleasures, you can never be a spiritual human being. Pleasures for its own sake. Pleasures for the spiritual sake is a different story. But pleasure for its own sake, my Rosh Yeshiva always used to say, that how do you know whether pleasure is permitted? How do you know whether you should allow yourself a certain pleasure? He used to say this. There are three ways, three stages. If the physical pleasure is just a pleasure, and you're doing it for its own sake, then you're never allowed to do it. Much too dangerous. It will suck you in and draw you in and make you... If the pleasure is connected to a mitzvah, let's say it's a finished mitzvah now, you're going to eat a wonderful meal that's physically enjoyable because it's a wedding now. Or sheva brachos. In other words, there's a mitzvah connected. That's much safer, but it's still very dangerous. You should still maintain control. Go along, eat the meal, enjoy it, but don't lose control because physical pleasure is so strong that if you can disconnect yourself from the mitzvah value and you can... But there's one exception, and that is when the pleasure is a mitzvah. When the mitzvah now is to have pleasure, like certain things on Shabbos maybe, and various other times, when the mitzvah is to enjoy yourself, that's completely safe. You can indulge as much as you want, you'll never have any harm, because you're doing a spiritual activity now, that's the unique capability of a Jew. But the physical world in general, for its own sake, has to be subdued to reach spirituality. And on the contrary, if you don't, the opposite happens. Now, and you see that in many, many, many ways. I'll tell you just that one classic source of it, again, you can see in the cassette of last night's discussion in much more detail. I think I mentioned this to you before. I'll just tell you one classic source is this. The Gemara says that, the Gemara teaches it in a fantastic way. The Gemara says that there was a man called Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya. I've mentioned it, I'll just mention it briefly. Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya was one of the greatest tzaddikim and the wisest sage of his generation in the days of the Tanoim. incredibly great man. He was called Chakim of the Yudoi, the greatest sage of the Jews, the wise man of the Jews. He saved the Jews many times in debates against the Romans that they were forced to have. But the unique characteristic of him was that he was terribly, terribly, amazingly ugly. He was hideously ugly. He was deformed. He was so ugly it was unbelievable. And the Gemara says that his praise was his body. The Gemara says that when his Rebbe had to say what his greatness was, he described him, Ashrei Yoladetoi. Happy is the woman who gave birth to a man like this. His mother gave birth to that body, and she tried to form his body into Torah. It says that when he was a little baby, she used to wheel his carriage into the Beis Medrash, so that he should sit there, he should lie there before he could understand anything, but his ears would be formed by the sound of Torah. That means he's the very tools of his hearing, before there was any spiritual level, he's the very tools of hearing would be formed by the words of Torah that he was hearing in the Beis Medrash. She was in. So what do you have? Listen to this. You have a woman who was able to bring into the world a man whose body was smashed, and was able to work with his body in such a way, with the physical element, which is what a woman builds and crystallizes in the world, that he should become the greatest man on earth. Now why? Why? Why is it that because he had such a body like that, he was able to be so great spiritually? Why is that? So it says one day he met the daughter of the Caesar of that generation, the Roman ruler of that generation. His daughter once met Rabbi Yeshua, and she was so struck by his ugliness that she said to him the following thing: Eich chochma mefo'eres bechli chochma mefo'eres bechli mefo'eres, like that. How could there be such a wonderful wisdom, a beautiful wisdom, in such an ugly vessel? She couldn't believe that there could be such incredible content. Why couldn't she believe that is another story, because a Roman woman, not a Jewish woman, a Roman woman, came from the Greek and Roman tradition, which is that aesthetics are everything. You follow? The Gemara is telling you something very deep here. We're not dealing with an idiot. The Gemara doesn't record the words of fools. This was a woman who had a world view that physical beauty, aesthetics, that is the spirituality. You know that the ultimate motto of art is art for art's sake. That's the motto of art. You know that? Which means that we're not looking for a spiritual content. The spiritual content is in the physical content. That's what aesthetics mean. So she said to this man, but I don't understand. How could you reach such a level when the aesthetic level is... So he said to the following thing. You see why he was the wisest man of the Jews. He said this. He said, what does your father, Caesar, keep his wine in? So she said, in wine jugs, like everybody else. Earthenware wine vessels. So he said to her, but surely that's not fitting for a king. Surely the wine should be in gold and silver. So she said, yes, you're right. And she went home and she had all her father's wine in the cellar put into gold and silver. Now, you know what happens when alcohol is put into metal? The acid in the alcohol leaches out the metal and it goes sour. The wine is ruined. So the next time the wine was served at the Caesar's table, the wine was off. So he said, what's going on? So she said, the Jew told me to do it. So they called in Rabbi Yeshua. So Caesar, the Gemara records, called in Rabbi Yeshua and he said to him, what's going on? So Rabbi Yeshua said, I simply told her what she told me. She said to me, how could there be such wonderful, beautiful content in such an ugly vessel? I tried to show her that when the vessel achieves importance, it ruins what's inside. The only way you can have beautiful content is the vessel stays simple. If the vessel is humble, it doesn't try... If the vessel tries to speak for itself, look how beautiful I am, then you can't have any content. If the vessel is so humble that it doesn't say anything of its own, it only contains, it's just enough of a vessel that it can hold what's inside, then what's inside stays beautiful. The price you pay is that the vessel isn't beautiful. But as soon as the vessel starts to become important, you know, the greatest man who ever lived was Moshe Rabbeinu, was Moses. And it says he was the greatest man because he was the most humble man who ever lived. Humble means that his own ego, who he was as an individual, was completely non-existent. So therefore he could be what Hashem was. He could be filled with Torah. As soon as the person says, well, this is me, my ideas, you know, what I want, and he starts to achieve a bigger and bigger ego, actually what happens spiritually, you shrink and shrink and shrink. You start to feel more like somebody, because your own separate identity starts to come into focus, but actually your content shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. The only way that you can actually achieve the paradox of living is that the way to achieve real inner existence is by completely negating who you think you are as an independent existence. Once you mevatel yourself, you make yourself completely subservient to Hashem's essence, what happens is a paradox happens. Not only do you contain the spiritual essence, but you become the greatest person who could ever be. That's the paradox. People think that if you give up your own ego to Hashem, so then you're a nobody, you're nothing. The paradox is not only aren't you a nothing, not only are you the greatest content of Torah that could be in the world, but you become the most famous and honored, you follow, human being that there could be. It's an incredible paradox. The Musa says this, that if a person runs away from honor, it will chase him. But only if you run away from it. If you try and achieve honor, So then you won't get that, you won't get anything else. But if you run away from honor, if you really try and run away from it, you don't want any, not only will you become real spiritually, but you'll be honored also. There was a man who came to the Chazon Ish once. I think I mentioned it to you. And he said, Rebbe, I've been running away from honor all my life and it still hasn't found me. So the Chazon Ish said, yes, because you're looking over your shoulder. So that's the idea. So now like this, you have a world where that's now. But perfection means that if you, by the way, the Gemara says, continues, that she said to Rabbi Yeshua, but one second, she was a very bright lady, this. And she said to him, but if you tell me that you have to be so ugly to be so great, what about your friends? There were Tanoim of that generation who were incredibly beautiful, unbelievably beautiful. It says that Rabbi Yochanan, who was much less than the people of that generation, he once went to visit a friend, one of the sages of that generation who was poverty stricken and ill, and he lay in a house that was completely dark. And Yochanan rolled up his sleeve to the elbow and lit the house, it says. He noticed that light in the house. He rolled up his sleeve by exposing his forearm. There was enough light to that's how beautiful he was. And this was a generation much greater than that. So this girl said to Yeshua, but you tell me you have to be ugly to be great. What about your friends who are so beautiful and they're very great? So without blinking, he said to her, had they been ugly, they would have been much greater. That despite being good looking, they achieved the level that they achieved. Despite that disadvantage, they had to struggle against the external. No, they had to work hard to subdue the external thing. For me, it was easy. You see that the world now is in that imbalance, and of course, that's why there's shame in the world, that's why there's clothing. You have to hide the outer reality because it doesn't reflect. That's what lies are. Lies are when you take the tool that's supposed to expose to you what's in me, and I use that very tool to say something that isn't in me. That's what sheker is. That's the shame and embarrassment. That's the evil of lies. When you tell a lie, the purpose of speech is to take what's inside me and share it with you. That's what it's designed to do. When you take speech and you make it hide what's in me and tell you something that isn't in me, that's what's the shame and the conscience and the agony and the evil of telling a lie. That's what it is. It's not truth anymore. Truth is when the outside reveals what's in the inside. The Gemara says that the Aron in which the Torah was kept, was gold outside and gold inside. It was wood in between, gold inside and gold outside. To teach you that a Talmid Chacham, which is the container of Torah, should be inside like he is outside and outside like he is inside. That's what you have to work on. That's beauty. Now, I'm not offended if you need. But briefly, we'll just finish like this. That's the problem of the world. Beauty means trying to go against that. Beauty means trying to be a person who can show that on the outside, by seeing the outside, you can see the inside. Sarah was beautiful. It doesn't mean, it means that her beauty as a woman, Yiska, you could see through it. Seeing through it means that when you looked at her, you saw Hashem. When you looked at her, you saw Hashem. That's what happened. You could see through her beauty. That's what it means. She was transparent. The mystics say that beauty is transparency. In Hebrew, you see it very, very beautifully. If you want to just examine this idea, I'll just share it with you. It's incredible to understand. In the words in Hebrew, the word for ugliness is ki'ur. Mecho'ar means ugly. If you rearrange the letters, it spells achur, which means opaque. The same words, you follow, the same letters that mean ugliness mean opacity. When you can't see through a thing, when you look at, what is muddy water? When you look at it, you see it. You can't see the bottom of it, but you can't see through it, you see it. So it blocks your vision. That's ugly. When you look at a human being and you see the human being, you don't see the spiritual, you don't see Hashem, you don't see a transcendent existence, that's ugly. It looks like a monkey. It looks like a horse, that's ugliness. When a horse looks like a horse, it's fine. It's beautiful. But when you look like a horse, that's ugly. Beauty means that when you look at a human being, you see something that on the outside looks like a horse, and inside you see Hashem. That means you see through. That's what beauty is. It means to see through. You know, if you want to try and feel this a little bit more deeply, the Hebrew word for clothing. Unbelievable thing. The Hebrew words for clothes all say this. The word beged, which means a garment, means treachery. You know that? Bagad, begidah means treachery. Because the clothing doesn't allow you to see who I am. When you look at the clothes, you think you're seeing me, but you see what the traitor is. Somebody who wears the uniform of one side while he belongs to the other side, that's what a traitor is. On the outside, he shows himself, remind me to tell you about Me'ila, okay, another word I didn't say last night, because you'll enjoy it. Listen to this tape, okay? The word beged means, actually it's much deeper, because spiritually, the word beged actually is the second, third, and fourth letters of the Hebrew Aleph Beis. It goes Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet. So spiritually what it means is the Aleph is the silent letter that never could be expressed, which is the pure inner core. And the only way you can see it is by the clothes that you put on it. You have Aleph, then you have Beis Gimel Dalet. But as soon as you get to Beis Gimel Dalet, immediately the word means a garment and it needs to be treacherous. Because now you're seeing the outside, you're not seeing the inside. Another place you see it is that the word for clothing, that's the word for a garment. The word for clothing in Hebrew is levush. Malbush or Labush. The Medaktikim say that the word Labush spelled Lobosh, not ashamed. Because you cover yourself with clothes, that's how you're not ashamed. So you see that the idea of them. There's a third example, it's incredible to understand this. There's a word in Hebrew, Me'il. Me'il means a coat. Me'il means a coat. It's the outer garment that you wear that completely covers the body, that's called the Me'il. The word Me'ilah in Hebrew, Me'ilah, means to illegally steal holy things. Isn't that amazing? When you take from the Beit HaMikdash, if anybody would steal for himself and use something that's designated for Hashem from the altar, from the temple, that's called Me'ilah. Me'ilah means that you're extracting from the holy dimension something to the secular dimension. That's what a coat is. It's a separation, you follow? It's a separation between the inner world of holiness and showing it on that. That's what it is. All these words mean the same. There's another word, a cloak, which is aderet, which is another idea I'm not going to go into. Now, Sarah, let's just finish like this. Sarah was a woman who was so beautiful that she was completely transparent. There wasn't this problem of the inner not revealing, the outer not revealing the inner. She brought herself to such a level of perfection, right, which is that the inner world could meet perfectly with the outer world. That's exactly what Machpel is. Sarah, how did she do it, by the way? If you want the clue, how does a woman do this? How does a woman generate this beauty? She doesn't do it by adorning her body. If you think you're going to get this by, you know, I don't want to get personal. If you think you're going to do this by either exposing the body or adorning the body, you know, by the way, that's allowed, okay? Especially in marriage, it has to be done. I'm not, don't get me wrong. But by emphasizing the physicality of the body is not the way this is going to be done. The way you do it is by hiding the sensuality of the body. Sarah was a woman whose beauty was emphasized in the world by how she hid herself. When the Malachim came to Avram Avinu, they said, "Where's your wife Sarah?" He said, "She's in the tent." And it says that Hashem did that to point out to him the greatness of his wife, that she remained hidden. She didn't expose herself to the eyes, you know, of the external world. A woman has to know that if she wants to develop that beauty, that the outside will reflect the inside, she has to do it by carefully clothing the outside in the correct way, so that the sensuality of the outside will in fact the sensuality of the outside, not by denying its sensuality, by revealing it correctly. I wish I could tell you some of the laws in marriage in this area which emphasize it incredibly. They're exactly the opposite of what people think. Come along in Santon when we speak to men and women separately, which I'm dead. But the laws of the intimate side of marriage are exactly a revelation of this thing, exactly the opposite of what people think. The sensuality has to be used, not the other way, not kills and denied. It has to be done in this way. That's what it is. So Sarah was a woman who was able to do that. She was able to make the external beauty be a reflection of the inner beauty, and she deserves to be buried in the Machpelah. The world where the inner beauty of the hidden spiritual world meets the outer form of this world, a cave within a cave, a situation of two things being doubled.